Principles of your first project. We talked this morning about sort of the five areas of a research project, and I just want to review those for you very quickly. Every research project should have a question or problem or provocation, a set of sources, whether primary or secondary, some sort of analytical or discovery activity. It should have an audience, and it should have concrete products. So what we're going to do is we're actually going to show you the difference between the types of elements you could have that fill these categories. So we're actually going to start with a question. So this is a very broad question. What is the role of Richmond, Virginia in the American Civil War? So this is a question that is common within the field of Southern history or Southern studies. It's sort of like, what sort of place, what sort of role did they have? And I distinguish importantly between this type of question, which is your sort of standard humanities question. And I'm going to point you guys to the problem they're doing and then tell you how this got reframed as a digital humanities question. So you understand the difference between a traditional question and a DH question. So the question that this project had was, or that this scholar had, was about what was Richmond doing in the Civil War? And he actually says specifically, this comes out of a problem in the historiography, in the literature of his field. Two guys had written a book, one in 1865 and one in 1997, two different guys, that basically said Richmond remains an offstage presence, a sort of metropolitan version of Hamlet's father, mentioned with frequency but rarely seen. So their problem or provocation was, you know, Richmond was the capital of the Confederacy, and yet none of the scholarship really talks about it. So they basically sort of thought about what would that mean if they converted this question into a digital humanities type question or project. So this is the provocation they came up with. Like, how do we do this in a digital humanities way? And the project that it became, Mining the Dispatch, seeks to explore and encourage the exploration of the dramatic and traumatic changes, as well as the sometimes surprising continuities in the social and political life of Civil War Richmond. So we went from a question that was, what was Richmond doing, to a question that said, we want to actually know about the social and political structures of what was going on in Richmond. So we took this very broad question, and because there was a problem associated with it, we narrowed it down to the types of information we're very much interested in. So we would expect this project to look at things like change over time, because they're not talking about Richmond at one particular moment. They're trying to capture Richmond from 1861 to 1865. So it's likely that this project will have some sort of time trajectory associated with it. It's also likely that this project, because it's doing sort of a geographic information systems, it's got a place located with it, that they're likely going to want to do things like assign information to particular areas or regions, and also to sort of recount information about the daily life. You know, that's sort of how you get social information, is you want to look at things like diaries and newspapers. So in terms of the sources that they'd want to be looking at, they'd want to look specifically at newspapers or, you know, reports from the battlefields of what's going on. What they're looking for at the end of the day is to find out something useful about Civil War Richmond. The reason why we sort of highlight that project is it starts from a place where there is a broad question and there's a problem in the discipline. Somebody in the discipline has called out that this is an area of scholarship that needs to be addressed. And the Digital Humanities Project then says, I can use digital tools to answer the question in this very specific way. So here's how you could do this process that they did, or refining a question. You begin with the sort of standard questions of humanistic analysis. Who, what, when, where, why, how? So these are the questions when we have students or when we're teaching a class for the first time, we say to our students, this is what a good essay has, the who, what, when, where, why, and how. But then you add a modification statement to describe something, to contribute something, to develop something, or to explore something. And so that I mean by you say you want your what answer to describe something that you're talking about, or your when answer to contribute to a particular issue in your discipline or in your context, okay? And you also add this for what purpose. What purpose is the answer going to serve? So in the case of Mining the Dispatch, the who, what, when, where was Civil War Richmond. It was, when you read through further in their statement, covering the period from 1861 to 1865. It is describing social and political life for the purpose of identifying dramatic and often traumatic changes and continuities during the period. In other words, their sort of abstract statement takes you through the big question, but it does it for a purpose. It wants to give you the information so that you get to the point where it's super specific about what they're going to do. The reason for this is the first time you write a statement like this, a reviewer is going to look at it and they're going to say, you've only got a year to do this project and you want to cover all of American history and every ethnic studies group through 2,000 years. You can't do that. You know, the more precise and the more narrow you get, the more manageable your project is. Okay? So in the case of Mining the Dispatch, they made their project manageable by specifically dealing with one type of material for their first stage, which is newspapers. They took digitized versions of the Richmond Dispatch newspaper and they looked for social and political information in it. And that's how they then did their analysis to tell us what's going on in Civil War Richmond. Okay? The tool that they used, if we go back to the earlier lecture about the tool that they used is something called topic modeling. What topic modeling is an approach that allows you to draw out the most important features of a body of text. So it's as if you were looking for every major topic or theme or area of discussion in a text, and it ranks them in order of, you know, these things are all related to one another. So God, love, country, war are all related to each other in the way that they're talked about in that document. What this does is it highlights for you particular ways that your material is related to each other. So, big grand question, modify it with some phrases for a specific purpose. Questions about that before I explain why it's so important to get to that specific issue when we talk about humanities versus digital humanities? Yes?
And this has to do with the developmental stage. I think we've talked a lot today about working in teams and working with other people. Is this something you think is more productive to do individually or to do together?
It depends on the team. So oftentimes how we sort of negotiate these sorts of refinements is each of us sits down on our own and makes our own set of notes about what we want the project to be or what we want the questions and the descriptions to be. And then usually what we do is get in a room together or use a collaborative document and everybody puts theirs up there and we sort of smush them in together and then start talking about it. So the most common strategy to do this is to literally start a document and have one person add a sentence and then have another person add a sentence and to keep iterating it until you're happy with it. Because then what you get is consensus about the meaning of the project. And this is different than the issue Kelsey had that she talked about this morning where, you know, she had a particular set of resources and the faculty came to her to use it. They already had their ideas of where they wanted to go. And they're sort of two horses pulling in the opposite directions because they never agreed initially what they were going to want out of it. So that's where something like doing this exercise as a team could be very useful in your initial stages. Other questions about broad question to small question? Yeah.
For grants like the any digital startup grant, you often have to prove like a wider humanity significance. That's the opposite of something very specific.
Yep.
So for like the writing studies tree, it's very clear how the composition and rhetoric community would use it, but we had to prove how like the greater community would use it. So how do you make a question that's specific but still broad?
So we're going to talk, we have an entire lesson specifically on statements of significance and how you do that. But one of the ways that you do this that we'll sort of preview for you is you think about how the methodologies that you use can be deployed across multiple bodies of content. So for example, in rhetorical analysis, the types of work you're going to be getting funding for oftentimes could be used for different countries, different moments in time, different people. So, you know, doing a political analysis of 1850s, you know, rhetoric around presidential campaigns, you could say the types of analysis we're going to do could be deployed in 1980 presidential campaigns. So you draw parallels to where there's potential for other scholarly teams to take what you've done and build on it themselves. And this is one of the key aspects of building a good question or building a good sort of statement of your question, is that you want to think about, you know, how big your question is and how little your question is. So the reason why I draw attention to the question issue is we're going to talk just briefly about the difference in the traditional humanities research process and a digital humanities research process. So I'm a historian, so I did this as a historian, but it actually is pretty universal for everyone. This is a process that is how the average sort of scholar does their research. Oftentimes, they sort of start with readings that they've done. So they start with sort of secondary source material that they read in school or read in classes or read on their own that generates then some questions that they have about their discipline or the things that they're reading. From those, they usually then are identifying archival resources to use. They go into the archive to do transcription and analysis. They usually read more material then, revise their question, and on and on. And at some point, they reach that lovely black box of producing their own secondary source material. So this is the process that, you know, most humanists are familiar with. This is the process that most of your administrators are going to be familiar with, is the sort of, there's one person, they sort of follow the process over and over again until at some point they spit out something to a publisher or to a book talk or, you know, a conference presentation. This is different than the model that's generally used by digital humanities projects. And I call this the semi-digital model, the semi-digital scholar. Oftentimes, it's easy to forget in the digital humanities that we still use analog print materials. And we forget that we move between print materials and digital materials. And so that's something to keep in the back of your mind, is that we're not advocating an entirely digital world for everyone. What we're saying is you need to be aware of the bonuses and the minuses of working in digital space and the pluses and minuses of working in print material, okay? So this is what a semi-digital process looks like. Oftentimes, the semi-digital scholar who does both hybrid print and digital has sort of their traditional process that they do, but they're tapping digital resources like a cataloging system or digital finding aids. They may even tap digital repositories like JSTOR or Chronolink America, and they'll pull down articles or they'll pull down some things. Oftentimes when they're doing transcription and analysis activities, they use Word or Zotero or other sort of common digital citation tools. And they basically sort of, again, iterate the same process, but they rely on some digital tools. So you get a little bit of the DH, digital stuff. But it's not actually about the sort of analysis and research discovery that we talk about in the digital humanities.
I'm just wondering, does this perhaps more reflect an evolution in the ways people do research, you know, a print culture versus a post-print culture? Because it seems to me, I mean, that very few people that I know, including students and scholars, can even manage the first, because I mean, everybody's going to sort of be pulling and culling from all of these archives now, you know, those that are digitized and those that aren't.
Right.
There's not anybody, I don't think, that I know of, that would go solely on the reliance of a print-based archive now.
There is and there isn't. So what is very interesting is that most people sort of exist now in this semi-digital space, mm-hmm. but they don't actually understand what the digital gives them and does not give them. So the number of people who think that when you go to a database that everything in the database, you know, encapsulates the entire world or encapsulates everything you could possibly get on a particular topic, or people who don't understand how databases relate to each other, so who may use one set of keyword search terms in one database and try and use exactly the same keywords in another set of databases and not realize why they're not getting any results. It's sort of that digital consumerness and consciousness mm-hmm. that's oftentimes still missing in this digital process. They're sort of, this is where a lot of the people are that want to say, this, you know, they're digital humanists because they consume digital resources, not yeah. they're digital humanists because they're actually, you know, building digital work or doing description and analysis. In other words, I differentiate a little bit between the people who are just sort of trying to use something that is exists as a digital form
right.
and people who are really interrogating it as...
Which also could be maybe... generational, because
it
I have
a lot
of students who were even taught coming in from high school that you have no reason to go to a library and look at a book anymore because you know everything that you need
yep.
is available. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, this is a good school, and and you know, we hear this all the time. So our sort of our challenge is getting them to go precisely what you're saying, and finding what's actually not out there,
right?
Or the projects that need to.
And the key element in this process is still that normally it is a single scholar attempting to navigate the process themselves. You know, so oftentimes this is the student who comes out of a course, a graduate course, or a colleague who's teaching a course for the first time or getting ready to write a book for the first time. And generally speaking, you have no idea what they're doing because it's just them in a room by themselves trying to do the work. This is not a public process at all. And that's the thing that I want to sort of point out, is that in this process, very few people reveal this process to the outside world. Most people only reveal the monograph or the article or the products of it. Very rarely do they talk about how they got all the way around the circle and what they had to learn and figure out. So if that doesn't blow your mind, we're going to talk about a little bit of the language and boundary issues, about what happens when you begin adding in people to your process that you sort of have. The first sort of language and boundary issue that I want to highlight is, you know, that there are presuppositions about how people do their research when they're in teams. The first one is that, you know, computers are difficult, which I know sounds really weird and simplistic to say, but the number of times people go to start working in digital projects or digital humanities and they say, well, computers are this like black box and there's things that go on inside the computer, but I'm not really sure what it does except when it spits something out at me. Well, yeah, that's true. Sometimes it feels like a black box, but computing has its own rationale, its own methodology, and its own theory. So don't always assume that when you throw something into the black box, that it's going to come right back out of the black box in a shiny, polished product. There's a process in the black box that works on it. And when you get to advanced stages of digital humanities and advanced digital products, oftentimes, you know, the digital humanists that are world-renowned because they pay attention to what goes on inside the black box and wants to figure out how those hidden processes behind the scenes work. The other thing I sort of want to say about presuppositions are about computer scientists themselves. As humanists, oftentimes the philosophy is that we'll just go find a computer scientist and they're going to help us out because, like, they know how to do these things in image analysis or text analysis or whatever. And what I want to sort of point out to you on that is computer scientists have their own disciplinary issues and aims. And the best products are one that are projects are the ones that partner with a computer scientist because the computer scientist has a question or a motivation of their own that matches the product, or matches what's going on with the project. So, for example, it could be a computer scientist who works in image analysis and wants to write a new algorithm. They fit with an image product, okay? So they're going to join your project team because they have their own motivation to answer that question. And so it's a good thing to familiarize yourself with computer science research and computer scientists who work in the area of scholarship you're trying to produce. So if that's large-scale text analysis, go talk to the faculty in your department or at your university who work in large-scale text analysis and say to them, what are you working on? You know, go to the talks that those departments have and say, what are you doing in these areas? The most successful digital humanities projects that are at the advanced level where they're using, you know, custom computer scientists are ones where the computer scientist is a full member of the project because they have their own research question in it, okay? And I want to say a little bit about presuppositions about humanists, too. A lot of people think that we're all eggheads who sort of, like, you know, talk a lot and don't ever really do anything, or, I mean, you can sort of throw out your pun about humanists here. You know, we're all super obsessed with our own work and whatever. It's important to know that as humanists, you know, we are people who have questions and answers and should be treated as such. I highlight that particularly because we're going to talk a little bit about power relationships. And it's important to remember that the staff around you are not just fodder for your project, that they need to be able to buy into what's going on. And by staff, I mean not just your graduate students or your colleagues, but your IT people, your university librarians. I mean, you sort of name them. They need to feel like they own the project as well, okay? One of the biggest debates is, like, are we ever actually getting to an answer in the digital humanities? Like, there's lots of projects going on, but they never seem to really kind of come back around to changing how we're doing something or learning something. And so one of the questions about sort of digital humanities is this probability versus certainty. You know, does A and B really equal C, or what was C really about? So it's important when you think about your project, you begin presenting on your project, that you think about saying things like, you know, this project is at this stage of work, and this is a preliminary answer to a question. It's not always vital that you present your work as something that is fully completed. What's vital is you say, this is what we know now, with these factors influencing what we know. And I highlight that because a lot of people think that what they see on the web is like a fully polished project and product. And in fact, oftentimes, that's a little bit of a facade that once you start to peel it back, as Simon talked about this morning with tools, you find that maybe it doesn't have the best methodology or it doesn't have the best sort of processes in play. So you want to think about peeling back the layers on projects you're looking at as exemplars of what you'd like to do. But also when you build your project, thinking about the fact that people are going to be analyzing your project based on a number of criteria. Okay? The other thing I want to say too is like recognizing where we are right now in computing is a big thing. We get people who show up who think like we ought to be able to mine the entirety of the corpus of human history, and like everybody's ready to do that, right? Or they figured out how to send terabytes of data to your cell phone. Not so much. So being aware a bit about what the computing tools you want to use can do and can't do, and that's where we'll talk about a literature review and sort of figuring out what your tool can and can't do is a big thing. We get this a lot with people who have this really great idea that's completely impractical to build because it would cost $35 million or is a service that already exists like with Google or Amazon and they want to build the next Google or the next Amazon. That's really great, but you're not going to take on Google. Good luck. Amen. Have a nice day. It's not going
to
happen.
And if anyone asks you to build a tool that transcribes handwriting, run
in the opposite direction as fast as you can. They've been working on it for 70 years in computer science and still cannot get a good handwriting character recognition tool.
It's come to me about once every 6 months.
Yeah.
They're wanting to do that, and it's you hire a student.
Yeah. Okay, so let me point out a little bit about sources and materials now that we've scared you sufficiently. part of what can motivate your project is a scarcity of materials. So we need to digitize more materials. We need to make more materials on this topic available. But also what can motivate your project is an abundance of materials. So we've got so many materials, I could never read them all. And computers and computing tools can address both of these. So the abundance category is always I've got a million books and we want to look at things over time in the million books. Computing tools can allow you to sort of tease things out of them without having to read every single document, every single word. Importantly too, because you can do this in a digital environment, you are not limited to just what you can do as an individual person in terms of reading every primary source material or every secondary source material. Imagine if you and your colleagues took all of your sources and all of your bibliographies and all of your books and put them together in a digital space. That's a pretty impressive thing when most scholars have, 200, 300, 400 books of their own. Imagine doing a project where you have 10 people who are putting 200 books apiece or 200 data pieces themselves into a repository together. Then you've got 2,000 pieces of data. So thinking about how you can sort of blend data together across pieces or across types of data to create a robust repository for your project is a good thing. It's important, though, to think about feasibility. We run a data training workshop for people because data is not a Word document, which is going to sound weird. Word is a type of file system that handles data with its own markup and its own structures. There are no digital humanities tools that use Word as a way to manage your data. And I know that blows people's minds because Word is what everybody uses when they write. But it's important to recognize that you have to think about what sort of status your data has and sort of what shape it's in. So if your data has lots of errors or file corruptions or naming issues, those are all things you have to clean up before you can start using those digital tools. Okay? And we're going to talk about how you wrangle your data and manage your data in a later lecture. But I want to highlight to you guys that feasibility, how clean your data is, it's a big thing, particularly if you're thinking about reusing your data for multiple projects or multiple years. And finally, quality and complexity. So, you know, thinking about your data being clean, but also thinking about how complex your data is. As humanists, we tend to think, you know, 100 documents is a lot. In computer science, 1 million documents is where they start. So you want to think about your scale of complexity. You know, do you have enough material at play in your project to get somebody who deals in the millions of documents interested? And it's okay if you don't. And that's one of the things that I want to sort of state right off the bat. There's a lot of hoo-ha at universities right now about big data, which is basically like large-scale, wieldy data sets that can be used for all kinds of research. And as digital humanists, you don't have to have large-scale data sets. And in fact, most digital humanities projects exist on roughly a terabyte or two of data, which is nothing compared to what they work in the sciences.
Doesn't that depend on what you're working on?
It depends on what you're working on.
In film, you know,
right.
That's nothing.
It's nothing. But even the number of even though the data size is large in film, usually it's still 10 or 15 films. So it's relatively small as a corpus, usually, in digital humanities analysis at least. Very few people do more than 6 or 8 or 10 films in a DH-type project. We still tend to think very sort of small and narrow. So the file size may be large, but the actual number of individual independent objects is usually still very small. And that's okay. It's okay to work with small amounts of data. So just a moment about this whole interdisciplinarity thing. So we've got a number of disciplines in the room, you know, library information science, history, English, finance and accounting, you sort of name it. Digital humanities grows out of interdisciplinarity, okay? It lies in the idea that there is some sort of generalized knowledge that we're all sort of thinking about or trying to get towards that has been synthesized and sort of integrated together. What that means is your audience is not always going to be an English faculty member or a history faculty member or a finance person or even somebody at your university. So when you think about your project, you want to think about who are the types of people that would be interested in this. So in the case of the Mining the Dispatch project, they actually had a wealth of people interested in the project because everyone and their mother loves the Civil War because we are heading towards the sesquicentennial. So it's gotten tons of pickup from hobbyists who are interested in the Civil War who want to play with and look at the newspapers that they have put online. They also got huge pickup because of the History Channel, who likes to do 1,001 episodes of why the Civil War happened and this battle and that battle. They actually can assign their project or align their project with these sort of public endeavors. So when Robert Nelson works on the project, one of the things he works on is how this thing gets pushed out to places like NPR and to the History Channel so that when they go to do their next version of the Civil War project, they could potentially show off Mining the Dispatch as part of that.